pussy. Three officers left the line that was trying to herd the demonstrators out of the courtroom. One of them grabbed the tall man by the arm, but he spun away.
Park Avenue, Justice!
Demonstrators now began surging through the breach in the line of officers, rumbling and growling and trying to figure out just how fierce they wanted to be. Sherman stared at them, paralyzed by the sight. Now it begins. A feeling of fear, anticipation. Now it begins. The court officers are falling back, trying to stay between the mob and the judge and the court personnel. The demonstrators are milling about, growling, baying, building up steam, trying to figure out just how powerful they are and how brave.
Boo! Yeah! Yeah! Yo, Goldberg! You bald-headed old pussy!
All at once, just to his left, Sherman sees the wild, raw-boned form of Quigley. He's joined the court officers. He's trying to herd the mob back. He has a crazy look on his face.
Okay, Jack, that's enough. It's all over. Everybody's going home now, Jack.
He calls them all Jack. He's armed, but the revolver remains somewhere under his teal-green sport jacket. The court officers are edging slowly backward. They keep moving their hands toward the holsters on their hips. They touch the butts of their revolvers, then pull their hands away as if terrified of what would happen in this room if they unsheathed the weapons and started firing away. Pushing and shoving, a terrific thrashing about. Quigley! Quigley grabs a demonstrator by the wrist and twists his arm behind his back and jerks it up, ah, and kicks his legs out from under him. Two of the court officers, the one called Brucey and the big one with a tire of fat around his waist, come backing past Sherman, crouched over, hands on the guns in their holsters. Brucey starts yelling over his shoulder to Kavitsky,
"Get on your elevator, Judge! For Christ's sake, get on your elevator!"
But Kavitsky doesn't budge. He's glowering at the mob. The tall one, the one with the gold earring, is barely a foot from the two officers. He doesn't try to get past them. He has his head stuck way up in the air on his long neck, yelling at Kavitsky,
"You bald-headed old pussy!"
"Sherman," it's Killian by his side. "Come on, we're going down in the judge's elevator." Feels Killian tugging at his elbow, but he's rooted to the spot. Now it begins. Why postpone it? A blur. He looks up, a furious figure in a blue work shirt charging toward him, a contorted face, an enormous bony finger.
"Time's up, Park Avenue!"
Sherman braces. Suddenly, Quigley. Quigley steps between the two of them, and with an utterly crazy smile, sticks his face in the man's and says,
"Hi."
Startled, the man stares at him, and in that moment, still looking straight into his eyes and smiling, Quigley raises his left foot and smashes it down on the man's toe. A terrific yelp. That sets the mob off.
"Yuck! Get him! Get him!"
Shoving past the court officers, Brucey pushes the tall black man with the earring. He goes reeling to one side. All at once, he's directly in front of Sherman. He stares. He's amazed. Face to face. And now what? He just stares. Sherman's transfixed, terrified.
Now!
He ducks, pivots on his hip, and turns his back. Now! It begins now! He wheels about and drives his fist into the man's solar plexus.
Ooh!
The big son of a bitch is sinking. With his mouth open and his eyes bugged out and his Adam's apple convulsing, he hits the floor.
"Sherman, come on!"
Killian is pulling on his arm, but Sherman is frozen. He can't take his eyes off the man with the gold earring. He's on the floor, doubled up on his side, gasping. The earring dangles off his earlobe at a crazy angle. Sherman is knocked backward by two thrashing forms. Quigley. Quigley has a tall white boy around the neck with one arm and appears to be trying to drive his nose back up into his skull with the heel of the other hand. The white boy is going, "Ah!" and bleeding terribly. The nose is a bloody pudding. Quigley is grunting, "Ah!" He lets the white boy fall to the floor, then smashes the heel of his shoe into his arm. A dreadful, "Ah!" Quigley takes Sherman by the arm and pushes him backward.
"Come on, Sherm."
"Sherm,
let's get the fuck out of here."
I drove my forearm into his belly, and he went, "Ooh," and hit the floor. One last look at the dangling earring. Now Quigley is pushing him backward, and Killian is pulling him.
"Come on," yells Killian. "You out of your fucking mind?"
There was only a little semicircle of court officers, plus Quigley, between the mob and Sherman and Killian and the judge, his secretary and the clerk, who squeezed back through the door into the judge's chamber, shoulder to shoulder, jostling about. The demonstrators, plenty for them to be furious about now. One of them is trying to push through the door. Brucey can't hold him back. Quigley. He's pulled his revolver out. He holds it up in the air. He thrusts his face toward the demonstrator in the doorway.
Okay, faggot. You want a new hole in your fucking nose?
The man freezes. Freezes like a statue. It's not the revolver. It's the look on Quigley's face that gets him. One beat. Two beats. That's all they need. The court officer with the big tire of flab has the door to the judge's elevator open. They're herding everybody on. Kavitsky, his secretary, the big clerk, Killian. Sherman backs in with Quigley. Brucey and Quigley right on top of him. Three court officers remain in the chamber ready to draw their guns, but the mob has lost steam, lost heart. Quigley, the look on his face. Okay, faggot, you want a new hole in your fucking nose? The elevator starts down. It's overpoweringly hot inside, all jammed together. Sherman realizes it's himself, gulping for air, himself and Quigley too, and Brucey and the other court officer, the fat one.
Sherm,
it's Quigley, talking between gasps.
You cold-cocked that cocksucker. Sherm, you... cold-cocked him!
Sank to the floor. Doubled up. The earring dangled. Now. And I triumphed. He's consumed with cold fear. They'll get me. And soaring anticipation. Again. I want to do it again.
Don't congratulate yourselves. It was Kavitsky in a low, stern voice. The whole thing was a fucking fiasco. You don't even know how bad it was. I shouldn't have adjourned the court so fast. I should have talked to them. They don't know. They don't even know what they've done.
Judge, said Brucey, it ain't over yet. We got demonstrators in the halls and outside the building.
Where outside?
It's mainly on the front steps on 161st Street, but some of them are around on Walton Avenue, too. Where's your car, Judge?
The usual place, the pit.
Maybe one of us ought to drive it around to the concourse entrance.
Kavitsky thought for a moment.
Fuck it. I won't give him the satisfaction.
They won't even know about it, Judge. I don't mean to alarm you, but they're already out there, talking about you. They got a sound system and everything.
Oh, yeah? Said Kavitsky. They ever heard of obstructing governmental administration?
I don't think they ever heard of nothing except raising hell, but they know how to do that.
Well, thanks, Brucey.
Kavitsky began to smile. He turned to Killian.
Remember the time I ordered you off the judge's elevator? I can't even remember how you got on.
Killian smiled and nodded.
And you wouldn't get off, and I said I was holding you in contempt, and you said contempt of what? Contempt of elevator? You remember that?
Oh, you better believe I remember that, Judge, but I always hoped you wouldn't.
You know what burned me up? You were right. That was what burned me up.
Even before the elevator reached the first floor, they could hear the tremendous brang of the alarm.
Christ, what jerk set that off? Said Brucey. Who the hell they think's gonna respond? Every officer in the building's already at a station.
Kavitsky was somber again. He was shaking his head. He looked so small, a bony little bald-headed man in voluminous black robes, squeezed into this sweltering elevator.
They don't know how bad this is. They just don't fucking know. I'm their only friend, their only friend.
When the elevator door opened, the noise of the alarm,
brang,
was overpowering. They emerged into a little vestibule. One door led to the street, another led to the ground-floor hallway of the island fortress. Brucey shouted to Sherman,
"How you figuring on getting out of here?"
Quigley answered, "We got a car, but Christ knows where it is. The fucking driver was terrified just fucking driving up to the building."
Brucey said, "Where's he supposed to be?"
Quigley said, "The Walton Avenue door. But if I know that faggot, he's halfway to fucking Candy."
"Candy?"
"It's the fucking town he comes from, in Ceylon, Candy. The closer we get to this fucking building, the more he starts talking about this fucking town he comes from, Candy. The fucking town is called Candy."
Bruce's eyes opened wide and he yelled,
"Hey, Judge!"
Kavitsky was heading through the door that led into the interior hallway of the building.
"Judge, don't go in there. They're all over the halls."
Now, again. Sherman bolted for the door and ran after the little figure in black. Killian's voice,
"Sherman, what the hell you doing?"
Quigley's voice,
"Sherm, Jesus Christ!"
Sherman found himself in a vast marble hall filled with the stupendous sound of the alarm. Kavitsky was up ahead of him, walking so fast that his robes were billowing out. He looked like a crow trying to gain altitude. Sherman broke into a trot to try to catch up. A figure came running past him. Brucey.
"Judge! Judge!"
Brucey caught up with Kavitsky and tried to grab his left arm. Sherman was now right behind them. With a furious gesture, Kavitsky forced the court officer's hand away.
"Judge, where you going? What you doing?"
"Gotta tell him," said Kavitsky. "Judge, they'll kill you. Gotta tell him."
Sherman was now aware that the others were pulling up on either side, running. The fat court officer, Killian, Quigley, all the faces in the hallway stopped and stared, trying to figure out what in the name of God they were looking at. This furious little judge in his black robes, with his outriders running along beside him, yelling,
"Judge, don't do it!"
Shouts in the corridor,
"That's him! Yo, that's the fucker!"
Bang! The alarm battered one and all with its shock waves. Brucey tried again to restrain Kavitsky.
"Let go my fucking arm!" screamed Kavitsky. "That's a fucking order, Brucey!"
Sherman broke into a trot to keep up. He was only a half step behind the judge. He searched out the faces in the hallway. Now, again. They went around a bend in the hallway. They were in the great modern lobby that led out onto the terrace overlooking 161st Street. 50 or 60 onlookers, 50 or 60 rapt faces, were inside the lobby, looking out at the terrace. Through the glass doors, Sherman could see the silhouette of a mass of figures. Kavitsky reached the front doors and pushed one open and paused.
"Bang!"
Brucey yelled. "Don't go out there, Judge, I'm begging you!" At the center of the terrace was a microphone on a stanchion, such as you might see on a bandstand. At the microphone was a tall black man in a black suit and a white shirt. Black people and white people were crowded in on either side of him. A white woman with wiry gray-blonde hair was next to him. A whole mob, black and white, was up on the terrace and on the stairs that led up to the terrace from either side. Judging by the noise, hundreds more, possibly thousands, were on the grand staircase and the sidewalk down below on 161st Street. Then Sherman realized who the tall man at the microphone was, Reverend Bacon. He spoke to the crowd in a steady, controlled baritone, as if each word were one more resolute footstep of fate.
"We have put our trust in this society and in this power structure, and what have we got?"
Much yammering and many angry shouts from the crowd.
"We have believed their promises, and what have we got?"
Groans, moans, yelps.
"We believed in their justice. They told us justice was blind. They told us justice was a blind woman, an impartial woman, see? And this woman did not know the color of your skin. And who does that blind woman turn out to be? What's her name? When she plays her lying, racist games, what's the face she wears?"
Shouts, boos, howls, cries for blood.
"We know that face. We know that name. Myron Kavitsky!"
Boos, yowls, cackles, shouts, a colossal bang noise rose up from the mob.
"Myron Kavitsky!"
The noise welled up into a roar.
"But we can wait, brothers and sisters. We can wait. We waited this long, and we got no place more to go. We can wait. We can wait for the power structure's henchmen to show their faces. He's in there. He's in there."
Bacon kept his face turned toward the microphone and the crowd, but he flung his arm and his pointed finger behind him in the direction of the building.
"And he knows the people are here, for he is not blind. He lives in fear on this island, in the mighty sea of people, for he knows that the people and justice wait for him, and there is no escape."
The crowd roared, and Bacon leaned to one side for a moment while the woman with wiry gray-blonde hair whispered something in his ear. At that moment, Kavitsky threw open the glass doors in front of him. His robes billowed out like enormous black wings.
"Judge, for God's sake!"
Kavitsky stopped in the doorway, arms outstretched. The moment lengthened, lengthened. The arms dropped. The billowing wings collapsed against his frail body. He turned around and walked back inside the lobby. His eyes were down, and he was muttering, "Their only friend, their only fucking friend." He looked at the court officer. "Okay, Brucey, let's go."
"No, now,"
Sherman yelled out.
"No, Judge, do it. I'll go with you."
Kavitsky spun about and looked at Sherman. Obviously, he hadn't even known he was there. A furious scowl.
"What the hell?"
"Do it," said Sherman. "Do it, Judge."
Kavitsky just looked at him. At Brucey's urging, they were now all heading back down the hallway at a good clip. The corridors were much more crowded, an ugly mob.
"That's Kavitsky, that's the one,"
shouts, a tremendous rumble.
Brrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr
An older man, not a demonstrator, came up from the side as if to confront Kavitsky, pointing and shouting.
"You!" Sherman lunged at him and screamed. "Get your fucking face out of the way!"
The man jumped back, his mouth hanging open, his expression frightened. Now, again, drive a fist into his belly, mash his nose into a pulp, ram a heel into his eye. Sherman turned to look at Kavitsky. Kavitsky was staring at him the way you'd stare at a lunatic. So was Killian. So were the two court officers.
"You out of your mind?" yelled Kavitsky. "You want to get killed?"
"Judge," said Sherman, "it don't matter. It don't matter."
He smiled. He could feel his upper lip stretching across his teeth. He let out a short, harsh, red laugh. Leaderless, the mob in the corridor held back, not sure what they were dealing with. Sherman sought out their faces, as if to obliterate them with his very eyes. He was terrified and quite ready. Again. The little band beat a retreat down the marble halls. Epilogue. A year later, to the day, the following article appeared on page B1 of the Metropolitan News section of the New York Times. "Financier is arraigned in honor student's death," by Overton Holmes, Jr. Former Wall Street financier Sherman McCoy was brought in handcuffs to the Bronx yesterday and arraigned on a charge of manslaughter in the death of Henry Lamb, a 19-year-old black honor student who had been the pride of a South Bronx housing project. Mr. Lamb died Monday night at Lincoln Hospital as a result of cerebral injuries suffered when he was struck by Mr. McCoy's Mercedes-Benz sports car on Bruckner Boulevard in the Bronx 13 months ago. He had never regained consciousness. Demonstrators from the All People's Solidarity and other organizations chanted, "Wall Street murderer, capitalist killer, and justice at last," as detectives led Mr. McCoy toward the Bronx Criminal Courts building on East 161st Street. Mr. McCoy's alleged role in Mr. Lamb's injuries became the center of a political storm last year. A patrician figure. Asked by reporters to comment on the contrast between his Wall Street and Park Avenue background and his current situation, Mr. McCoy yelled out, "I have nothing to do with Wall Street and Park Avenue. I'm a professional defendant. I've undergone a year of legal harassment, and I'll undergo another, or perhaps another 8 1/3 to 25. This was an apparent reference to the prison sentence he will face if convicted of the new charge. Bronx District Attorney Richard A. Weiss is said to have prepared a 50-page indictment to present to a grand jury. Mr. Weiss's tenacious prosecution of the case was widely regarded as the key to his successful bid for re-election in November. A tall, patrician figure, son of the eminent Wall Street lawyer John Campbell McCoy and a product of St. Paul's School and Yale, Mr. McCoy, 39, was dressed in an open-necked sport shirt, khaki pants, and hiking shoes. This was in sharp contrast to the $2,000 custom-tailored English suits he was famous for as the legendary $1 million-a-year king of the bond market for Pierce & Pierce. As he was ushered through a basement door of the courthouse into the Bronx Central Booking Facility, Mr. McCoy said in response to a reporter's query, "I told you, I'm a career defendant. I now dress for jail, even though I haven't been convicted of any crime." Diminished lifestyle. At his arraignment 6 hours later, Mr. McCoy appeared before Judge Samuel Auerbach with a slightly swollen left jaw and abrasions on the knuckles of both hands. Questioned about it by Judge Auerbach, he said, clenching his fists, "Don't worry, Judge. It's something I'll take care of myself." Police officials said Mr. McCoy had become involved in a dispute with two other prisoners in a communal detention cell, resulting in a scuffle, but had declined offers of medical treatment. When the judge asked him how he pleaded, Mr. McCoy said in a loud voice, "Absolutely innocent." Against the judge's advice, he insisted on representing himself at the arraignment, and indicated he will do likewise during his forthcoming trial. Sources close to Mr. McCoy, whose worth was once estimated as more than $8 million, said that a year of extraordinary legal expenses and entanglements has left him barely able to pay the rent. Formerly the owner of a $3,200,000 cooperative apartment at 816 Park Avenue, he now rents two modest rooms in a post-war high-rise building on East 34th Street near First Avenue. The original charge against Mr. McCoy, reckless endangerment, was thrown out last June during a turbulent hearing in the courtroom of former Supreme Court Justice Myron Kavitsky. Amid the ensuing storm of protest in the black community, Mr. Weiss brought the charge before a second grand jury and obtained a new indictment. The Bronx Democratic Organization, responding to community demands, refused to renominate Judge Kavitsky, and he was soundly defeated in his November re-election attempt. He was replaced by veteran Justice Jerome Melnick. Mr. McCoy's trial, in February, ended in a hung jury, with all three white jurors and one Hispanic juror holding out for acquittal. 2 months ago, a Bronx jury awarded Mr. Lamb $12 million in a civil action against Mr. McCoy, who has appealed. Recently, attorney Albert Vogel, acting for Mr. Lamb, charged that Mr. McCoy was hiding assets in order to evade the judgment. The assets in dispute are the proceeds of the sale of his Park Avenue apartment and his house in Southampton, Long Island, which he attempted to give outright to his estranged wife Judy and their 7-year-old daughter, Campbell. The court has frozen these funds, along with the remainder of Mr. McCoy's securities and saleable personal belongings, pending the outcome of his appeal of his civil damages. Mrs. McCoy and her daughter reportedly have moved to the Midwest, but Mrs. McCoy was in the spectator section of the courtroom yesterday, apparently unrecognized by the noisy group of demonstrators, black and white, who occupied most of the seats. At one point, Mr. McCoy looked toward his wife, smiled slightly, and raised his left hand in a clenched fist salute. The meaning of this gesture was unclear. Mrs. McCoy refused to speak to reporters. Rent-controlled love nest. Mr. McCoy's marriage was rocked by the revelation that Maria Ruskin Chirazzi, heiress of the Ruskin Air Charter fortune, was in the automobile with Mr. McCoy at the time Mr. Lamb was struck. The couple, it developed, had been conducting an affair in a secret apartment later dubbed the rent-controlled love nest. Mrs. Chirazzi's then-husband, Arthur Ruskin, died of a heart attack shortly before her involvement in the case was made known. District Attorney Weiss had been prepared to begin a new trial on the reckless endangerment charge when Mr. Lamb died, exposing Mr. McCoy to the more serious charge of manslaughter. Mr. Weiss had already announced that Assistant District Attorney Raymond I. Andreuti would head the prosecution. In an unusual development, Mr. Weiss was forced to remove the prosecutor of the first trial, Lawrence N. Kramer, from the case when it was disclosed that Mr. Kramer had interceded with a landlord to secure the so-called rent-controlled love nest apartment for a friend, Shelley Thomas, an advertising copywriter. Mr. Kramer, who is married, met Ms. Thomas when she served as a juror in an unrelated case which he prosecuted. The defendant in that case, Herbert, Herbert 92X, Chantrell, has obtained a reversal of his first-degree manslaughter conviction on the grounds of prosecutorial misconduct. Mr. Andreuti said yesterday that he would call Mrs. Chirazzi as a prosecution witness in Mr. McCoy's new trial, despite the fact that it was a controversy over her testimony before a grand jury that led to the dismissal of the first indictment by Judge Kavitsky. She did not testify at the first trial. Fashionable estate. Mr. McCoy's legal problems were multiplied yesterday when a real estate firm employee, Sally Rothrode, filed suit against him in Manhattan's civil court for $500,000. Mrs. Rothrode had received a $192,000 commission for the $3,200,000 sale of Mr. McCoy's Park Avenue apartment, but Mr. Lamb, via Mr. Vogel, sued her for the $192,000 on the grounds that the money should go toward the payment of Mr. Lamb's $12 million judgment against Mr. McCoy. Mrs. Rothrode's suit yesterday accused Mr. McCoy of deceptively proffering encumbered property for sale. In a statement, she said she was merely hedging against the possible loss of my rightful commission and, in fact, wishes Mr. McCoy well. Just how Mr. McCoy might deal with this and other complex legal matters growing out of the case was uncertain. Reached at his home on Long Island, Mr. McCoy's former attorney, Thomas Killian, said that he was no longer able to represent Mr. McCoy due to Mr. McCoy's lack of sufficient funds to mount a defense. Mr. Killian himself currently has his hands full with a barrage of lawsuits brought by his new neighbors in the fashionable North Shore community of Laddingtown. He recently purchased the 20-acre Phipps estate and commissioned the noted neo-shingle architect Hudnall Stallworth to design a large addition to the main house, which is listed by the National Historic Registry. Local preservationists object to any alteration of the stately Georgian structure. Mr. Killian is heated in his support of Mr. McCoy, however. In a speech before a private luncheon group yesterday, he reportedly referred to the manslaughter indictment with a common toroscatological expletive and was quoted as saying, "If this case was being tried in foro conscientiae, in the court of the conscience, the defendants would be Abe Weiss, Reginald Bacon, and Peter Fallow of the City Light." Milton Lubbell, spokesman for Mr. Weiss, said the district attorney would not respond to kibitzing by someone no longer involved in the case. He added, "Only preferential treatment by certain elements of the judicial system has kept Mr. McCoy aloof from the law so far. It is tragic that it has required the death of Henry Lamb, who represented the highest ideals of our city, to see to it that justice will at last be served in his case." Buck Jones, a spokesman for the Reverend Mr. Bacon's All People's Solidarity, dismissed Mr. Killian's charge as the usual racist double-talk by a racist mouthpiece for a well-known capitalist racist, who seeks to avoid paying what he owes for the racist destruction of a fine young man. Mr. Fallow, winner of a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the McCoy case, could not be reached for comment. He was reportedly on a sailing vessel in the Aegean Sea with his bride of 2 weeks, Lady Evelyn, daughter of Sir Gerald Steiner, the publisher and financier. This concludes the reading of The Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. Copyright 1987 by Tom Wolfe. This book was read by Joe Barrett. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Tom Wolfe and was produced in 2009 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.